Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
One, two, three, four, five.
Why is there, like, salad items on top of the chips?
Well, it was actually a fish and chips, but I've already had the fish.
They do fish and chips?
Yeah, they do fish and
so
chips.
So that's debris from the now extinct fish?
Yes, yeah.
Right.
What a night. What a night here at the Australian Open. It has been incredible. We've had Rafael Nadal beating Nick Kyrgios in a really, really entertaining match over four sets. So we got that to talk about while we sit here with our six beers and our two plates of chips. We've got Stan Wawrinka knocking out Daniil Medvedev. We've got Simona Halep. We've got Garbiñe Muguruza rolling back the years and beating Kiki Bertens. We've got Alexander Zverev getting to a quarterfinal without dropping a set. You what? So we got all that. And we've got an interview with Goran Ivanišević about life with Novak Djokovic. He gives us chapter and verse about what it is like coaching Novak Djokovic and his role. That is all coming up on this edition of the Tennis Podcast. Before we do that, though, I'm going to tell you about our episode sponsor, the Queen's Club. The Fever Tree Championships are sponsoring this episode of the Tennis Podcast, which is lovely for us because we've all got a bit of a vested interest in the Fever Tree Championships, as you all well know, because I'm the media director. Catherine's worked at it for years and now presents Amazon Prime Video coverage of it. Matt looks after the entirety of the social media for that tournament, so we all love it anyway. And Keith Prowse, who look after the hospitality at the tournament, have got in touch and they have sent me all the details of their packages for this year, and I want to go and sample them all, but I'm going to be working. So I'm going to tell you a lot about them very quickly before we get started on this edition of the Tennis Podcast. Basically, you know the tournament. It's the one before Wimbledon on the grass courts, arguably the best grass courts in the world, certainly some of the best at Queen's. Loads of great players. Andy Murray and Feliciano Lopez winning the doubles last year, and Murray's won it five times, of course, and has got a career-long commitment to the event, so hopefully if he's fit, he'll be back. Keith Prowse, what they do is they lay on the wonderful hospitality experiences. You can go and wine and dine yourself in a lovely VIP area. You can get premium seats on centre court. You can have, there's five different restaurants or suite settings if you choose the type of thing you want, whether it's formal or private or shared with friends or corporate clients, whatever you want. They've got the lot, and you are guaranteed to make sure you get a courtside seat, which, given that they go pretty quickly, is worth having. So go and have a look on our show notes. Scroll down right now. You can see what they've got to offer. There's a link there. And if you want to go and have a VIP day out at the Fever Tree Championships, you can do that. Can we do that?
I mean, I can't do that.
You can. Can you
but
do that?
I'd love
now?
To.
No, I well, spend my week at Queen's in a lovely room with lovely people, but without any windows, and I very rarely venture outdoors.
Well, maybe we should just give ourselves all a day off.
The violins out.
And go down to the hospital. I've walked through the hospitality area once or twice over the last 20 years and thought, one day, I'm going to do this because it looks really, really, really nice. Anyway, so that's that. What a day we've had. Let's start with the match that we've just witnessed, which I felt was unlike any of their previous matches. In terms of match score symmetry, it was identical to the Wimbledon one. It was 6-3, 3-6, 7-6, 7-6 to Rafael Nadal, exactly as it was at Wimbledon. And yet it could not have been more different in terms of feel as a match. Here's where I'm coming from. At Wimbledon, it was full of animosity. It was full of aggravation. Now, I love that, right? But I actually loved tonight more because we saw Nick Kyrgios almost embody Rafael Nadal in the way he went about his business. He ran every single ball down. He gave unconditional effort for 3.5 hours, 2 days after putting 4.5 hours in. And I loved it, seeing that.
I absolutely loved it as well. I did say to Catherine afterwards, is it bad that I preferred the more aggro-heavy match at Wimbledon? Because that's how I felt.
I have to say I'm surprised to hear you say that, David.
I found it genuinely uplifting to see Nick Kyrgios
Agreed.
Do something that he's never done before, because he's always had a trick up his sleeve. He's always caused chaos. And I love the chaos, don't get me wrong, but this was new. This was him putting his heart on his sleeve for the cause of trying to win the match. And haven't you always found yourself thinking, what would it be like if Nick Kyrgios gave everything? And tonight we found out.
Yeah, and I loved that too. I really did. And I loved most of what he had to say about it afterwards and what Nadal had to say about him. And I 100% agree with you. But I just hope that there's a world in the future in which he does that and there's also room for just a little bit more aggro.
Of course there is.
Yeah,
I mean, you don't think...
As I say, I feel like he's giving himself a margin for error at the moment. I feel like with the aggro.
You don't think he can keep this up, do you? Come on. He's not going to do this every match.
No, I was
all prepared to say absolutely not. Let's see this in isolation and not expect anything. You know, the standard Kyrgios, you know, post Kyrgios success patter. See post Washington 2019, and then we went to his press conference, and some of what he had to say convinced me just a little bit. I mean, he wasn't as eager as I thought he would be to dampen down expectations of the future in terms of this being a watershed.
And also I think the reality for Kyrgios and the reality for Australia is that these bushfires are still going on. It's not a thing that the Australian Open's over and therefore this issue is over in Kyrgios's mind. And I still think as long as he's got that on his mind, perhaps he can continue thinking that, even though it's not in Australia.
I mean, I'd also point out, Matt, because Kyrgios would want me to, his Australian Open is not over.
This is true.
Because the theme of the whole press conference was, I'm still in the mixed doubles. And that, you know, he was asked about his schedule going forward. He said, well, I'm down to play New York and Delray Beach, but we'll see about that. All I'm thinking about now is the mixed.
he can't keep this up, I actually think there is a chance now that he can build on this, that this could be a platform for him to do more. But before we get into that, let's just talk about the match itself, because I think it deserves that. The first set, Nadal was brilliant for most of the match, actually. I mean, there were some messy bits. There were some bits where he put some unforced errors in when I wasn't expecting them, but for the most part he just knuckled down and made life difficult for Kyrgios, and the first set was comfortable, 6-3, half an hour. Second set, Kyrgios he held on, didn't he, at the start of that second set. There were multiple break points
and it all turned. I thought he saved a break point with a rally that included a tweener.
Yeah.
And I thought it all turned after that. Suddenly he got himself going. He got some spark. He came onto the court pretty flat, I thought, in that first set. I mean, we should probably point out the wider context of this match.
Yeah, we really should.
Is the tragic death of Kobe Bryant and his daughter.
We heard overnight.
And the other seven people on the helicopter.
We heard overnight this morning, woke up to this news, and, I mean, the entire tennis world stopped for this news. Kobe Bryant, if you didn't know, apart from all this, is obviously his fame and his stardom and an incredible sporting career in basketball, is a huge tennis fan and came to the US Open and had pictures with all the players, sat in Naomi Osaka's support team when she played, and has got to know a lot of the players.
He wrote a children's book about tennis, aimed at young girls, inspired
really?
By his daughter in tennis, and by all accounts, it's really good.
It's
somebody that, you know, one of these celeb people that liked coming to the tennis and having his picture taken with tennis players. Genuine love of the sport.
And let's be honest, Kobe Bryant is a bigger name than probably all the tennis players, really, in many ways. Maybe you might say Serena and Federer are similar, but, you know, it's in America certainly. Basketball completely overshadows tennis in terms of awareness. He was coming for the love of the game, and people were, people worldwide are devastated. Of course, they are. How can you not be about news like that? But it really hit a lot of the players, I think, very hard. And Kyrgios, in particular, a huge basketball fan himself. I think 2 days earlier he'd come to his press conference in an LA Lakers vest and shirt as it was.
Even though he's a Boston Celtics fan.
Yeah, well, I think
he was practicing in one the other day as well.
Yeah. And he came out onto the court today in the Kobe Bryant shirt, number 8. And he went through the entire knock-up in it. We thought for a while that he might even play the match in it. And he changed, but he'd got tears in his eyes when he sat down.
His lip was quivering. He was crying.
Yeah,
he was crying.
And it was very, very moving to see that. And it's not surprising. I mean, it's human nature anyway. But he's shown himself to be somebody who is touched by a lot of things other than just his own situation.
And he said in his press conference that he was inspired by it today. I think everyone knew it would affect him. I don't think anyone quite knew how. I don't think anyone would have been that surprised if it had completely overwhelmed him, and it would have been a really difficult thing to deal with. But he said he used it as motivation when he was down in that match. He thought of Kobe Bryant and the values he stood for. And he was really, really strong and really good about that.
Specifically referenced the fourth set, didn't he? He said, when I was a breakdown in the fourth set, I thought about Kobe and what he stood for. And
wow.
Yeah, it was and very interesting.
And Rafa Nadal spoke very, very from the heart as well afterwards. Novak Djokovic, I saw 2 days ago, had been in the ESPN studio talking about Kobe Bryant and how inspired he was by him and how they'd spent a little bit of time together. And so, you know, it's just a measure of how devastated people are and will be over the next couple of days. So that I was interested to see how Kyrgios handled that, because he seemed so tired in that first set and a bit overwhelmed by everything. And obviously he'd got 4 hours and 27 minutes in his legs.
Well, except he said he felt fine physically. Whatever was going on in that first set, I don't think it was due to those 4 hours, 27 minutes.
Right.
I mean, there was no reason just now in the press conference for him to bluster how he is physically. If anything, it would have been a get out to say. He said he was up for it if it had gone to five.
Early on,
physically, he was okay.
He had no timing early on. That was what I noticed. And the one thing that occurred to me was all of his other three matches are played on the Melbourne Arena. Suddenly he comes out onto the Rod Laver Arena, different feel completely as an arena and as a sound. Yes, people were into it or giving him a good reception, but it's nothing like that ground pass bunch of spectators out on Melbourne Arena. The visuals are going to be different, and he,
there's no backpackers.
No.
And I think also part of it is mental. I think he has completely convinced himself that Melbourne Arena is his turf.
Yeah.
And I think he then goes out onto the Rod Laver Arena and goes, oh, well, this isn't the same.
And it affects his ability to be alpha, I think. Because on Melbourne Arena, he's weed all over that place.
Yeah.
In, to use a dog analogy, David just looked at me like, oh, my God, what she just said. It's a dog thing, David.
I'm with you. Don't worry. The thing is, Nadal, by contrast, is weed all over the Rod Laver Arena.
Yeah.
In terms of territoriality. Because he's never off there, is he? And so it's his turf. This has taken a turn I did not expect. But, you know, it all makes sense, folks. And the timing on the backhand, it always seems such a reliable shot, the Nick Kyrgios backhand. It might not damage players in the way that his forehand can and his drop shot can, but it's always reliable. In the first game or two, he dumped three of them halfway up the net, or one on one long, and it was, you could see it certainly from where we were, court level, you know, just how he was miscueing the backhand. I was very familiar to me, but for a player of his standard, not.
And I feel like that backhand is so important when he plays Nadal, because it's so, I mean, because of the short take back on it and the way he just seems to bunt it, it always seems surprising. Even if it's just a routine shot, something about it just always seems like, oh, that backhand's come out of nowhere. And disrupting Nadal, as we know, I mean, whether it be via aggro or via your tennis, is so important. I just feel like that backhand is just by its very nature disrupting.
And that's the word, I thought, disrupting, because he wasn't doing that in the first set and he started doing it in the second set, but not with his attitude or not with his personality. It was with his tennis.
Yeah.
And that was fun to see. And because if Kyrgios doesn't do that, if he doesn't mess Nadal around, Nadal is one of the few players who Kyrgios isn't better than in terms of just the basic fundamentals of tennis when you consider the whole package, because Nadal can move better, he hits his forehand better, he's more physical, dynamic in the rallies,
and his backhand is destructive.
So Kyrgios needs to bring a bit of that chaos in terms of tennis to bear to beat Nadal, and he started doing that from the second set onwards, and he pretty much carried it through for the rest of the match, which he didn't do at Wimbledon. That was one of the biggest differences. I thought he did it in the second set at Wimbledon.
He was full of explosions at Wimbledon, arguing with the umpire, etc.
Exactly. He messed Nadal up that way, which
got
was
him
maybe
angry.
Was maybe more fun.
Went for the body line. Yes. Flat
and then, and then came into press after and said, yeah, I was aiming at him.
Yeah. It was.
He's won loads of Grand Slam titles. He's won millions of dollars. Yeah. If you can't take that, you know.
Yeah. Not his best comment ever, but.
No.
It was quite fun. I did enjoy that, but I admired Kyrgios more today with the, for the way he was able
to
commit and sustain
Thing is,
that style.
I've had my fill of Nick Kyrgios. Fireworks and chaos and circus. We've had it for 6 years and he's got nowhere really with it in terms of actually achieving anything. It's great fun, but it's kind of ultimately meaningless. Tonight felt meaningful.
I feel like he's grown a bit tired of himself as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. But the other two things I wanted to say is, one is, being down where we are at the end of the points, when they finish, the player down our end, and we are on the end of the court, walks towards us to get the towel, and you see their reaction to whatever's just happened. The number of times Kyrgios laughed at how brilliant Nadal is. It was comical. Now, things that Kyrgios was doing to stay in points were miraculous, and yet Nadal would hit sidelines and then hit the other sideline and then do it a third time, and Kyrgios just was... How can he do that? How come he keeps doing that? It's crazy, and the look on his face was just such a tell, an entertaining one, you know, and one of huge respect, really.
And I mean the comments from both of them after the match, it was just a loving.
It was, yeah.
It was a disappointing loving. I mean, not disappointing. I'm as delighted as you are. What Kyrgios showed tonight.
I'm
being
sides.
Facetious, but I feel like there's just room in the future. There's room for that, plus just a little bit of aggro.
Look, he's going to fall out with somebody, isn't he? He's just made up with Nadal. It's like the films, isn't it? You know, with a happy ending.
We now need him to be drawn in Djokovic's half.
Yes. I also would like to. I mean, I'm sure we'll take a bit of time to pay tribute to Nadal, but. I know this is nothing new, but the fact that I'm still struck by it, despite it being nothing new, is amazing in itself. Just Nadal, I mean, some of the stuff that Kyrgios has said about Nadal in the past year is, I mean, he would be completely validated in just, regardless of what attitude Nick Kyrgios shows on the court, just hating him forevermore. You know,
he's been out of order.
He's been out of order. He said some not good stuff.
Entertaining, but if you were Nadal,
absolutely.
You'd be well in your rights to think, well,
absolutely.
You, mate.
And he really genuinely only seems to care about the greater good of tennis. Tonight, he only had good things to say about Nick Kyrgios and just said, yeah, if he plays like that and respects tennis, I love him. I'm all for him.
He said,
I've watched all of his matches so far this tournament. He said, I love watching Nick Kyrgios.
And on court, he said,
I mean, he's so much bigger of a person than I would be. I would just never be prepared to say anything good about Nick Kyrgios for the rest of my life if he had said that sort of stuff about me. I just wouldn't have it in me.
He just
cares about tennis. And I just it intimidates me how big a person he is. I need to go and do some Nick Kyrgios style working on myself, becoming a better human.
The quote at the end on the court was, "I like the Nick Kyrgios we've seen at this tournament," and I thought that really does sum it up very well, because suddenly Nadal could relate to Kyrgios on the court, because Kyrgios was behaving pretty much like Nadal during the rallies. He was almost impersonating Nadal. In set four, when he was knackered and he managed to turn it around, he played a few rallies as if he was Nadal. He would smash his backhand cross court to try and get him out of court, and then he would stand in that corner so he could be running around the backhand to the forehand and whip it the other way. And he was trying to do to Nadal what Nadal had spent 2.5 hours doing to him, and it was just so fascinating to watch.
Yeah, crucially, he was impersonating the good bits and not the service motion as he was doing the other day.
We've always said before that, you know, I've always felt like with Kyrgios that his subconscious has been saying to him, if you don't 100% try, then you can't 100% fail. Well, I felt like he did 100% try tonight, and I don't think anybody here would say that he failed.
No, not at all. I thought the whole thing was just a massive triumph, and in the nicest way, a continuation of what he showed two nights ago against Khachanov. And it needed this, because his career is going nowhere, really, isn't it? If he doesn't, which is fine if he's not bothered. He's often said there are more important things, which there are.
His career is going into the mixed doubles tomorrow, David.
Yeah,
that's
what he would be keen to tell you.
But crikey, just imagine if we could have a bit more of this.
This is the trap, David.
Well,
I've got good evidence, though. You know, of what he can do now.
You've got one tournament.
Yeah.
We've never had one tournament before. I'm not saying you're wrong, but this is the trap.
Not at the Slam. We've never had this at a Slam.
2014 Wimbledon.
Yeah, that was just fireworks. That wasn't this.
Yeah, this was different. This was different.
I agree it was different, and I'm not saying I disagree. I'm very aware of the trap.
And look, you know, the next...
I'm as hopeful as you are.
How you get to the next... I mean, this was a bit like his period of Indian Wells Miami in 2016
and 17
and obviously that didn't lead to anything substantial, and that's the problem. There are periods of nothingness in the tennis calendar
for some of these tournament guys. Directors of New York New York, Delray Beach and Acapulco, which are what he cited as his next scheduled events, I wouldn't be feeling 100% confident based on what he said in tonight's press conference.
I was struck watching that match. I was thinking, how does Kyrgios beat Nadal in a big match in a Grand Slam? And I think my overwhelming feeling was that he needs to get there more and fail more, and then he'll know how to do it. I just think these...
Like Tsitsipas.
I just think these one-off matches, if he's getting there every now and again, he's not going to be able to beat Nadal. I'm going to rehash something I said at Wimbledon, but Nadal was asked in his press conference just now about the fact that he's won the four tie breaks against Kyrgios, two here and two at Wimbledon. And he kind of said, there's no real reason for it. I can't explain it. I just have. And I think he's massively underplaying the fact that he is so used to these high-pressure situations. It's that quote that Jill Ellis, the US coach, the former US coach of the women's football team in the States said that some teams visit pressure, we live there. And Nadal lives in high-pressure situations, so he's going to perform better in those tie-breaks. Kyrgios doesn't play many matches of real high stakes. He plays them every now and again. And I think if he can put himself in this position more, he will start winning. He'll lose more. But then eventually he'll learn what it takes to win those tie-breaks.
And that's the thing. The ones he plays in Acapulco and Washington.
He can do it.
He can do it, but it's not that big a deal either way, is it? Let's be honest.
No.
They're good tournaments, but when he gets to these, everybody else is peaking and something happens and Kyrgios lets himself down. And he has not let himself down at all at this tournament.
No. And it was just to one more thing on Nadal. What just struck me was that third set tiebreak. Kyrgios double faulted at 5-all. Nadal double faulted at 6-5. And then the next point Nadal played was one of the best points he played in the whole match. His ability to just immediately put that double fault behind him is unique, I think. Completely unique. He then played the gutsiest point, came forward, finished it with quite a difficult high backhand volley. And I just thought that right there is the biggest difference between them.
Yeah, I think you're
right. Because Kyrgios' tennis is great. It's not quite as good as Nadal's, but the massive difference comes Nadal's just able to deal with those situations better because he plays them more, I think.
So Nadal against Dominic Thiem in the next round, because Thiem has beaten Gael Monfils pretty handily today. When you think of it in those terms, this is a heck of a draw Nadal's got to come
through, really,
isn't it?
Yeah, it feels like that should be a semi-final. How can that be a quarter-final? It feels unfair. Incidentally, that Monfils team match, Nadal confessed just now to having watched pretty much all of that. And that would have been in the build-up to his night session match tonight. I found that interesting.
Straight sets for Thiem.
Very routine. Really
very good. Straight sets.
Very straight sets.
Despite an underarm serve from Monfils.
And that was the thing. Monfils didn't bring anything different to the court apart from that one underarm serve. You're waiting for him. He's lost 8 sets in a row against Thiem. He often loses these big matches. What's he going to do differently? It just wasn't really anything. And Thiem's just a better player than Monfils.
Yeah. And afterwards, Thiem came into his press comments and Matt Roberts went to it.
I did, yes. And I obviously wanted to ask him about why he stopped working with Thomas Muster just a week after, 2 weeks after he started working with Thomas Muster. So I asked him, and he said, the first thing he said is nothing bad's happened. He was keen to stress that. And he said, it's just a feeling I have that it wasn't going to work. So I pressed him and I said, why have you got that feeling? What is that feeling? And he said, well, I'm 26 now and I just think I know my career and I just know when something doesn't feel right, which I thought was quite a mature answer, really, because there were a lot of people who thought that maybe he stayed with Gunter Bresnik a little bit too long, that partnership had run its course long, maybe a year or so before he actually decided to split with him and take on Massu. So I thought it was quite a mature answer. And then he said, and actually he's really happy with his team that he's got. It's worked really well. So then I wanted to ask, well, why did you want Muster in the first place if you're happy with your team and it was working well? And I was cut off by the press conference moderator.
Oh, that's
in your prime.
I mean, look, I think most of the people who run the press conferences here are really good and are very experienced. I'm not sure who the particular person was in that instance. I think in that, and look, I think when a player is being kind of hectored or harassed about a particular subject that they've made it clear they don't want to talk about, at some point, I've moderated a lot of press conferences, at some point you do have to step in and say, look, the player doesn't want to answer any of this anymore, let's move on to something else. I read the transcript of the presser there and Dominic sounded as though he was fine with it. In that particular instance, so that's unfortunate. Do you feel 2 days away from that match? Do you feel that he has a real chance against Nadal?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Mark Woodford was saying yes. that he felt that he has less of a chance on this surface against Nadal, and that Nadal's form is really fine-tuned now, having had this match. But
so is teams.
What was the less chance on this surface compared to?
I think probably compared to clay, I guess.
Really?
I feel
just
the opposite.
Don't see that.
But I think the biggest thing is, I think we've talked about this before, that yeah, team might be better on clay, but Nadal is so much better on clay that, that he ends up widening
the gap.
It's
closer on this surface.
Team is a better clay court player than he is hard court player, without a doubt. But Nadal on clay is in a different stratosphere.
Greatest of all time. By far.
Yeah.
So, hold on then. As we stand right now, and we've got 24 hours until we make predictions on that match, who are you picking?
Well, Matt and I are in a corner here. I think we're in the same corner.
I think
we
all are.
Are we? All in the same corner?
And that we all picked team before the tournament.
I picked that quarter final, and
have
I picked team winning it.
You have, yes.
I can't remember what I picked.
And, well, really, nothing I've seen should really change my mind, I suppose. I really have been impressed by Dominic Thiem. I know he sort of dropped what you could perceive as a couple of unnecessary sets maybe against Alex Bolt, but yeah, I really have been impressed by Dominic Thiem. And I think he's ready to do this.
I think he's ready, yeah.
Well, the winner of that match would face the winner of Zverev and
Wawrinka.
Oh, Wawrinka. Wawrinka against Daniil Medvedev this afternoon was just joyous. Because Medvedev, I'm not necessarily saying Medvedev played his best tennis. I didn't watch the whole match, but they went all the way. They went five sets. I felt it was just a lovely contrast of generations, really, of Medvedev's everything he brings to the table versus everything Stan brings to the table.
Medvedev was happy with the tennis he played.
Was he?
He said, I've no regrets. He said, look, I could pick out the odd shot here and there. But he said, basically, I played really well. And Wawrinka was just incredible and better than me today and deserved to win.
I just thought it was a fascinating matchup in terms of, I think I said to you at lunch stroke dinner, whatever time we ate this today. It was a slightly strange time.
You say today. It's 1 a.m.
Okay, yesterday. Who's the alpha? I was thinking, because Wawrinka loved beating Tsitsipas at the French Open. He loved just putting him in his box for just that tournament to say, I'm still here. You know, I've been away, I'm still here. And I think he got that same satisfaction out of beating Medvedev today. And he also said, Wawrinka, that this was the best he's played since the surgery.
Wow.
Which are big words, because he played pretty well at times last year, particularly that Wawrinka match. But he thought this was the Tsitsipas match. But he thought this was a level up. And I would agree with him. I went out for the final set. It was a joy. It was such a joy. I found myself just laughing at the crack of the ball as it connects with his strings is unlike anything else in tennis, and the winners he hits off both wings is unlike anything else in tennis, and it's basically unbeatable when he plays like
plus,
that.
Plus, when he follows those ground strokes with a winner and a roar, one of his own roars, it has the whole stadium with him, doesn't it?
And we were saying, Catherine, that we think his pointing to the head is one of the more iconic most iconic image that you see on a tennis court at the moment in terms of a player's celebration.
There aren't very many iconic celebrations doing the rounds at the moment.
No, that is a good
show
one.
Show me a more iconic celebration than the Wawrinka head point.
It's very signature, isn't it?
And it's also useful if you do social media like I do, because it works in emojis. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Just on Medvedev, sorry, I think it links in with what Mats Wilander was saying on our podcast yesterday in his chat with you, David, in that he was talking about Medvedev's physicality maybe not quite being there, and we were questioning that.
Yeah.
Well, he's never won a five-setter, Medvedev. He's now zero wins and six losses. Now,
really? Wow.
It's strange, isn't it? I still don't necessarily think it's a physical thing. didn't feel physical today. I just think he got outplayed in that. Yeah. In that fifth set.
Well, and there is a mental element to a fifth set match, not just surviving it, but winning it.
Mm.
You know, can you elevate when you're tired? And look, he certainly did, obviously against Nadal at the US Open, but he didn't win.
Yeah.
And that's the problem in these. Most of the time you play five set matches, they're at Grand Slams, and they're often going to be against players like Nadal and Wawrinka, which is a real tough one.
Vavrinka's head-to-head against Zverev is 0-2.
Right.
And but those two matches were 2016 and 2017, which was in the dark period for Vavrinka.
2017,
yeah,
certainly.
2017.
And that was peak Zverev.
Peak Zverev.
Yeah.
Although maybe he's peaking again.
Well, the thing is, suddenly Zverev is bringing his tour form to a slam for the first time. We've never seen this before. And he's into a quarterfinals. He has not dropped a set, 12 out of 12. And he beat Andrei Rublev today pretty comfortably.
Handily. He came on about, I don't know, I don't quite know how long after the Nadal-Kyrgios match. 45 minutes after, maybe. And he was finished well before that match had finished. It kind of just passed everyone by, I think. And I think I think Zverev's benefited from being not talked about this tournament as a contender, because quite frankly he said in his very charming and great on-court interview, I didn't think this was happening after the ATP Cup. How could he possibly think that? Because he was serving double faults left, right and centre. He was having a real meltdown with his box.
What, with his family?
With his family, yeah. And suddenly he's got here. He's much calmer, much more confident on the court again. He's hitting, he's stepping in, cracking his backhand, which Simon Briggs always describes as like Djokovic's backhand, but, you know, with the burners on, it's even faster. He's looking really good. And it's nice to see him relaxed and more confident again on the court.
Yeah, it is. Wawrinka against Zverev. On the women's side today, Garbiñe Muguruza continued this form that she's shown throughout this tournament, just reminding us of what she used to be like from 3 years ago. She's beaten Kiki Bertens easily today. Who's she play next, Muguruza?
Pavlyuchenkova, who is with her former coach, Sam Sumik.
Oh, crikey, that's interesting. And Pavlyuchenkova beat Angelique Kerber today.
She hit 71 winners in that match.
It was two tie breaks and then a more straightforward one, wasn't it?
Yeah, so the head-to-head going in was 7-all, Kerber and Pavlyuchenkova. Kind of surprising that they've played that much and that it's been that close.
7-all?
7-all, yeah.
Crikey.
And the match completely bore that out because it was so close. And I felt really bad because it was happening on the Margaret Court Arena at the same time as Nadal Kyrgios, and I think a lot of Margaret Court ticket holders were out in Garden Square or on one of the banks watching one of the screens watching the Nadal Kyrgios match, and it was an empty stadium. Yeah. It was a real shame because the match was such high quality, so good.
71 winners.
Yeah,
in a three-set match.
Yeah, 55
from
in the
one
first
player.
Two sets, and it
was unreal.
If you consider, I was going on about how good Kyrgios against Khachanov was the other day. Kyrgios hit, I think, 95 winners in five sets.
Mm.
This is 71 winners in three sets. Mm.
Yeah,
against Kerber, who gets everything back.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
was playing brilliantly herself. This is okay. It's not the kind of tournament that Kerber has put together in the past, and you know she's a three-time Grand Slam champion, but this was a positive tournament for Kerber, I think, based on the form she showed last year. She played really well. She was just beaten by a player possibly playing one of the best matches they've ever played.
Wow.
And as much as Muguruza played down the Sam Sumik element in her post-match press conference, I should say at the time that she went to press, she didn't know whether it was Kerber or Pavlyuchenkova she'd be playing, but she was asked about the option of facing Pavlyuchenkova. I really do get the impression that that is a factor, for sure. I think it's a factor that Muguruza will respond really well to. I mean, I genuinely don't know what went on there. She just describes, you know, needing a different energy and
Martinez,
a cycle running its course.
Martinez came into press today as well, didn't she?
She did, yeah. And she was asked about sort of, do you feel... She was asked, you know, whether you were aware that kind of how natural it felt for you and Muguruza to be together, kind of the tennis world sort of willing you to get back together. And I was expecting her to bat that away, that question. And she said, she kind of said, yeah, I was aware of that. She said, you know, it's like Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. Everybody wants them to get back together. She said we were like that, which was just a lovely little comment.
Brilliant.
And it's they both, Muguruza, perhaps Matt, you can shed some light on this. She talked about a complicity, that's the word she used, that she and Conchita have with one another. Now, obviously, that's not the right word in English, but it's obviously something I can sort of get a sense of what she means by that. She means, you know, we're on a wavelength, and
yes.
I wonder what it's like when Nadal says it's complicated. That's a thing in Spanish,
yeah.
Isn't it?
And when he said infamously now about Kyrgios, maleducado, which is not anything to do with being badly educated, as Kyrgios took that to mean, it's being rude.
Yeah,
there are some little subtle differences that the Spanish players then just translate into English, but they do lose a little bit of that meaning.
Yeah.
And Muguruza said some interesting things about how she is aware of the fact that the hard court slams are the ones she hasn't won, and therefore they do feel a little bit extra important to her. She has a mind on the career slam.
I found that really interesting. Again, it was a question I was expecting her to bat away.
I could definitely
in the way that tennis players do, you know, she was asked this one in the US Open have heightened importance to you? Is this something you've discussed with Conchita? And she said, yeah, I am aware of that. And I loved seeing that naked ambition from her, because frankly, that's something I've questioned over the last couple of years, that raw ambition and desire, and I really saw that today.
And she's not the same. She's not the same person without that. She because I love her attitude and the fact that she walks around like she owns the place.
Yeah.
And really, you know, when she's at her best, she's just such a presence.
And that aura is back on the court with her. And I still can't. I'm pretty sure that as surprising as this run is for Muguruza, I don't think any of us were calling it to happen so soon after getting back with Martinez. It's far less surprising that she's doing this than it was that she fell away altogether.
Yeah.
That was the real shock with Muguruza. It feels right now that she's doing this again, because we know just how good she is when she's at her best.
Muguruza against Pavlyuchenkova, and the other one that was set up today, the other quarterfinal set up today, is Simona Halep, who beat Elise Mertens in straight sets, and she was good because Mertens was hitting loads of winners, but she still couldn't get the win.
Mertens is a far more powerful player than I had realised. I think it's perhaps because she takes the ball really early.
And it comes from timing.
It's Justine Henin-esque power, isn't it?
At 2 a.m.
I know that's a very lazy comparison because she's Belgian, but it is. It's power that entirely comes from timing.
Mm.
It's, you know, really slight frames.
And that was a really good match, Halep against Mertens, straight off 11 o'clock this morning.
Halep's playing really well.
She's
going to take
Halep
some
alert.
And on this court as well, the surface, it's a, you know,
how do you get the ball past
a little
her?
Slower. How do you do it? Well, the next player who's going to try to do it is Anett Kontaveit, who defeated Iga Świątek today in three sets, three really close sets, tiebreak and 2-7-5s. Kontaveit, I'm just so pleased for, because I know her coach quite well, Nigel Sears, and I've spoken a lot to him about her over the time when we were commentating together, but also because of how unwell she was after the US Open, 6 days in hospital following this stomach infection, and missed the whole of the rest of the year. It's incredible, really, that she's come out here and she's never reached a quarterfinal of the Grand Slam before, and here she is in it. Brilliant.
Yeah, that must have been such a big match for her today to get over this hurdle, because she's been in, I think, three fourth rounds before, and you start building up that baggage, don't you? And for her to get over the line in this match was really impressive, because Iga Świątek was playing brilliantly, did have a little bit of a hamstring injury, it looked like, Świątek.
There was a point in the third set where she looked incredibly hampered, and then all of a sudden she'd broken back.
Yeah, she was charging back at her. So for Kontaveit to resist that was also deeply impressive.
Yeah, I think it's a big ask for her against Halep, though, I would have thought. But we shall see in a couple of days' time. Should we hear from Goran Ivanisevic?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yes, I've heard this interview. It is great.
Catherine with a big sell. We know Goran well. We spoke to him a year ago, and I think it was pretty much a year ago to the day, and exactly in the same seat in the player area near the transportation that I ran into him yesterday. An interview I did for BBC Radio, because that's who I'm here for this week, but they've kindly given us permission to use it here on the Tennis Podcast. And we had a sit down, and I said a year ago, you know, you just lost your man Milos Raonic in the quarterfinals at the Australian Open, and here you are now with Novak Djokovic, who's about to play Milos Raonic in the quarterfinals tonight as we talk to you here at 1 a.m. And I asked Goran how it's going.
It's going perfect, you know. Hopefully he's gonna talking about Raonic, he's gonna stay in the quarters like last year. But it's going to be tough. He's playing very well. He's serving unbelievable. But I think Novak is in great shape, great form, coming from ATP Cup, winning a lot of confidence, and it's going to be interesting.
What are you trying to bring to the team with Novak?
Craziness. I know. I think he's serving better. Second serve is like serving 180, 190 seconds. He didn't serve like that before.
So are you telling him to do something different?
I didn't tell him to serve 190 second serve. But, you know, we did some little changes with the ball toss. And now he's confident and he believes that he can serve harder, you know, even first serve, even second serve, you know. And it's tough to teach the guy who is past 9 years the best tennis player in the world. So it's but still, you know, those guys, they want to improve every day. That's the different what between them, three of them I'm talking, and young guys, because they are not afraid to ask, listen, change. Roger changed something, Rafa changed something. Novak every day wants to learn what can I do better. And that's why they're still the best, and they're going to be the best, because young guys, they think they know everything, they think they're smart, and they, you know, you can't tell them anything, because they are like, and that's why they are there.
That's very interesting, because I was reading a big article, big interview with Novak today in the New York Times, and he was saying that. He was saying that, you know, I want to learn all the time, and I just find that really interesting that it never stops.
Yeah, sometimes you think, I mean, what a heck, you want to learn more. You know, everything you've been, you won 16 grand. But, you know, these guys are pushing each other. Young guys are coming, but still they're not consistent enough. And it's great to, as a coach, to have a player like that who wants to listen, who wants to learn, who wants to, you know, improve every day, and it's really something that you cannot have better person for that, and also mentality, same language, and it's easier for me to talk, to explain, you know, what he's thinking, because I was thinking pretty much the same on some difficult moments. So it's a great, it's working great. And Marian, guy who is the nicest, easiest guy to work with,
Marian Vajda,
you know, and you know, in the beginning, you know, I need to learn a few things, you know, how to approach. No, you know, everybody works different. Everybody is different, you know, and it's a perfect mixture. Marian talks more, I talk less, but, you know, together we make the perfect team.
One of the things that I noticed also in this article, it said that, I know that Novak, at the end of last year, at the start of this year, stopped working with the data analyst, Craig O'Shaughnessy, and the article said that was your thinking, maybe to stop thinking so much about numbers.
These statistics, in one way, they are good. Shows you some things, but when it's going too much, I don't like it, you know, because too much information, you forget how you have to play in the end when you come on the court, you know. Who cares about the other guys? I mean, you are the number one in the world. Let other people think how you're going to play. So we decided that was maybe too much, that generally Novak wants to, you know, like, know all the things, little things, how he did that, but still we can do that by ourselves, by watching the matches, telling him something. But too much philosophy is in the tennis, too many, you know, these wrong people, they're becoming important, which is wrong. I'm an old-fashioned guy, and I can't say bad words, but I don't approve of this. Too much statistic, it's makes your brain gone.
just looking at the fact that this season started differently this year because the ATP Cup was part of it, I did wonder whether, and Novak had such a high in front of that crowd and that moment, he really, and I wondered whether it might be difficult for him to have enough energy to peak again, if you like, for the Australian Open. Now he's had a really good run of matches. He looks like he's got so much in the tank. He hasn't had any long matches. Do you think that is a factor at all, that does it, in terms of approach?
No, he needed ATP Cup. ATP Cup came from the, it's like a gift from the god, because first of all, he had a huge help from Lajovic, who won a couple of matches, Troitsky doubles, but he needed that for the confidence, you know, because he did not finish the year good in his standards. Okay, he lost number one, that's a different thing, but he did not perform great in London ATP Finals. You know, he was kind of not there with his mind. And he needed something to lift him. We had a good preparation in Dubai, and he needed that. And this came perfectly for his confidence. So he is very confident, gave him extra energy, different kind of energy that you can get only with, you know, being pumped. And he had a great support by Serbian community. So I think it's a huge success, this ATP Cup.
Yeah, it does seem to be. Just finally, two final points. One is Milos next. Now, he's playing really well. He's had a good win over Marin today, another player you coached. He had a good win in the previous round against Stefanos Tsitsipas. But he's never got really close to Novak. He's 0-9. I mean, I just wonder how you assess that match.
But first of all, Milos, he's was never a problem of how good his tennis player he is. He's an amazing tennis player. He's always was problem of his fitness. Guy plays 1 month and then 3 months he's injured. So, you know, if he can stay healthy, he can be easy top five. Easy. Novak returns well, you know. Miller doesn't like when somebody, you know, return those unbelievable serves, and then he's forcing, and from the back, Novak is very solid. but he has to be careful. Miloš improved from the back, he's playing well, he's attacking, but it's a different story, you know. Playing a guy who gets everything back, and Cilic was not 100% fit today.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, isn't there? Goran Ivanišević, he did not hold back there about giving information about how the relationship works with Novak Djokovic, which I found really interesting in its own right, about how they work together and what he feels he's brought, and also the decision to move totally away from the data analyst. Big thing to have done.
Yeah, the wrong people have become important.
Yeah, which, you know, and it's interesting because I raised the subject with Leon Smith, the Great Britain Davis Cup captain, in commentary on BBC Radio. We listened to that interview on there and asked him what his thoughts were about that. And he said he did feel that over the years, tennis had been behind all the other sports in terms of getting data and using statistics. And what had happened in recent years is tennis had suddenly caught up at an incredible rate. But what has ended up happening is it's just overwhelmed everything else. And he said, as a coach, what you have to do, and he said, I've found this when I'm on the coaching bench and the Davis Cup and stuff, I've got access to all this stuff, but the players, there are some players that want to know all of it, but there is some of them that just say, look, just tell me something simple.
But that's,
you know, I don't
but
want
that's
all
the
this.
Skill of a good data analyst, right?
Yeah.
That it's a form of translation. It's I agree. I mean, the volume of data available in tennis relative to the quality of data analytics in tennis has been incredibly poor. You know, you look at the way cricket uses analysis, you know, just in broadcast terms is incredibly insightful and enlightening, and tennis has been behind. But the skill is in the translation and digesting what's important and presenting that, and not overwhelming. Just because you've got all this data doesn't mean it's all interesting or pertinent.
I quite liked the way he discussed their relationship generally as well, about how honest he was about how much you can tell a guy who's won 16 slams, and yet Djokovic is still keen for it. He wants Goran around, he wants to tap into it, and just that. I often wonder, and we've talked about it because of Thomas Muster and Nicolas Massu, how do two coaches work together? Well, they seem to have got it absolutely worked out. I think Goran said to me before we did the interview, I do two slams, he does two slams, pretty much, in terms of the prep and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, he's got no ego about it, does he, about coaching? I think he's so secure in his own self and his own achievements that in being a coach, he doesn't need to have an ego.
No, and he doesn't need the money either, so, yeah, you know, because he's done well for himself.
Yeah, and, you know, it's that you're not able to be a coach to the best of your ability if you're afraid of being fired.
Yeah, I agree. I do agree with that.
It's the vicious circle, isn't it? It's a real conundrum.
So, yeah, we'll see what impact Goran can have against his former player, Miloš Raonic, in tomorrow night's match, because that is the night session match on... What day is it? Tuesday.
No idea.
Tuesday. It's Tuesday today, folks. And so the day starts with Sofia Kenin against Ons Jabeur. Looking forward to that. I don't want to ask everybody for predictions because we don't know what we're going for the newsletter yet.
Somebody proposed that we should get to reset our pre-tournament predictions and redo them at the quarterfinal stage because they're so decimated.
Because I don't think we've got anybody left,
have
we?
Which is either a great idea or we're just going to be wrong twice now.
Yeah.
We have got this one spectacularly wrong, folks. Then it's Ash Barty against Petra Kvitova. Oh,
cracking match.
Shouldn't
We're
be where it is in the schedule.
Very confused why it's going to be at about 1 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah.
There's just no way that's where that should be.
I think, am I right in thinking that they're using a singles match in the night session for the first time this year on Monday and Tuesday? I don't remember that being the case last year. I'm not sure. Because, I mean, I agree with you. I do just think... The fact is, the whole of second week, all of the night sessions are men's matches.
Mm.
exclusively. And that is not right.
It's wrong.
No, it's
they
not
do
right.
So much right at this tournament, and that is not right.
It's one of my biggest bugbears. We'll get to it later on in the tournament, but the two women's semi-finals take place in the day on a Thursday, and then there's one men's semi-final in the evening, and then the other men's semi-final gets a whole day to itself, and it's the night session match. Yeah. And it just always feels so wrong.
I mean, so what we're saying is anybody who's at work tomorrow can't see Ash Barty against Petra Kvitova.
I just don't... If that's a men's Australian world number one, there's just no way that match is being played there at that time.
Well, I mean, it's not, but it's not just against Ash Barty, it's against... It's just a policy. Men's matches are in the evening.
But if it were a men's Australian world number one, they would bend the policy.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it just wouldn't happen.
Just don't understand
whatever.
Why it's set up this way. I'm sure they could sort that out. And I know there's the element of making sure people have enough rest, etc. Well, you need to reorganise the whole thing there so that that doesn't become a factor. Just start it again. Chuck it all up in
the somebody's
air.
Arms behind their back and saying, oh, we can't let them juggle.
Just, it doesn't, it's wrong. That match is followed by Tennis Sangren against Roger Federer, not before 2:30 local time. Then Milos Raonic Djokovic in the evening session. Have we got anything on Margaret Court Arena? We've got the doubles. No, we haven't got any other singles matches. Should say as well, the Bryan brothers lost today, and that means their Australian Open careers have come to an end. And, what a great credit they've been.
Emotional scenes.
Yeah, and they've got their families out there, I think, and they are going to have... It's basically a lap of honour now, isn't it, for the rest of the year, which I'm really chuffed about.
I think, obviously, every player can decide how they want to retire. Simona Halep was actually asked in her press conference the other day, have you, based on Wozniacki, not that you're going to retire, but have you thought about how you might like to? And she said she thinks she'll be announce it before the tournament, and then she'll be out of here, a bit like Wozniacki. But I do quite like the idea of this victory lap lap of honour.
And it wouldn't suit necessarily everybody, but for them who give so much, who are always prepared to step up and help a tournament or sign an autograph or do an interview, whatever, they can get their moment in the sun everywhere they go.
I think it depends whether you like goodbyes. I mean, I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle a whole year. If everywhere you go, everybody's thinking, oh, will this be the last time I see you? I'd better, you know, people like, oh, I'd better give you a big emotional goodbye just in case it's the last time. Oh, my God, no.
I would one and
keep
done.
It a seat, yeah.
Or not even that, not even announce it.
I mean, you know,
it.
It'd be nice to have a, you know, a cake.
I'd happily just ring it out everywhere I go.
Yeah. 18 cakes with 18 tournaments.
Oh, just, you know. Let me have a nice lap of honour. Just make me feel good everywhere I go. That's fine. Right, okay.
But you'd have that awkward, like, you'd have said goodbye to somebody the round before, and then you'd see them again. It'd be like, oh, did we do that emotional goodbye again? Like, anxiety dream.
I'd be fine with that. Right. Just give me fuss.
We're different people.
Just fuss around me, folks. It's fine. Matt?
I was just going to say, last thing on today, we should probably mention that the... ceremony to honour Margaret Court's 50th anniversary of winning the Calendar Grand Slam happened. It was buried, should I say, in a press release that it was going to happen at 6:45, 15 minutes before the night session. And the whole ceremony was very... dumbed down in compared to what they did with Rod Laver last year. I went back and watched the one for Rod Laver, and Rod Laver had a chance to speak, and Novak Djokovic was on the court with him at the same time, and they made a real fuss of him. They didn't do the same for Margaret Court, and she wasn't given the chance to speak, for example, and the whole thing just felt like something that...
It was a box-ticking exercise,
a box
I think, from
exercise.
From Tennis Australia.
Yeah.
I have
a bit
to say,
of a mess,
really. I mean, as just as a PR move, I think that they were very clever. They got Rod Laver out onto the court with her, and if anybody did come out with the intention of booing, they'd have basically been booing Rod Laver. Mm-hmm. Not that, yeah. not him directly, but he would have. That would have been how it came across. And it that. How could you do that?
And their wording was very specific. We're honouring her achievements.
Yes.
Not her.
As you say, it's clever from a PR perspective. I totally understand why they did it that way, but it's a fudge. Either do it and stand by doing it and say, look, we believe in the detachment of somebody's achievements from their beliefs. We believe in that principle and we are going to honour these achievements and therefore honour those achievements with gusto because those achievements are tremendous. Or say you cannot detach those two things and we don't think it's appropriate to honour her and don't.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree with you. I end up seeing it from their perspective as well, just because I suppose I'm in that business and I see how they've tried to do it. But yeah, ultimately, I agree with you. John McEnroe very, very strongly against what they did. By the way, he spoke out about it on Eurosport, didn't he? So that's that for another tennis podcast. Hope you're enjoying them, folks. And we've got three shout outs to three of our backers that have enabled us to be here.
How many of them live in Casa del Lor?
Well, let's find out, shall we? Who have we got?
Laura Myers.
No, don't know Laura, but Laura, Laura, you're amazing. So thank you for backing the tennis podcast.
Aaron Bearden.
Aaron, you're a top bloke. Thank you.
Not in your house.
No, never met him, but love him.
And Scott Johnson.
Scott, tell you, me and Scott. never met him, but what a bloke. Scott, good lad. Thanks for your backing.
Thank you all
Seriously.
Very much. Have you noticed how I'm picking the ones with the easier to pronounce names?
I am noticing that. However, we do try very hard and we will continue to. So thanks everybody for the support. And yeah, keep telling people about the tennis podcast because if you like it, maybe someone else you know will like it. Tell them. Leave us a review on iTunes if you haven't yet. Join our Reddit community, which has a link in our show notes. Don't forget as well the Fevertree Championships hospitality packages that we were talking about at the start of the show. It's amazing. Go and have a VIP day out at the Queen's Club. Link in our show notes. And yeah, don't forget our newsletter because Matt's stat will be waiting for you, as will our predictions for tomorrow. Although why you want to see those, I don't really know, given how good we are. Just for a laugh, you know, have a laugh at us. Catherine's thinking, hold on, actually I'm winning the prediction, so no, you can come.
I'm reluctant to gloat too much on the predictions front.
Well, you are winning that bit. I'm losing spectacularly.
And in fact, that bit is the bit where there's a really excellent graph. there's a graphic.
She's actually got a graphic. She's.
It is.
I didn't make the graphic, but it is. She looks so great.
She spent about 10 minutes just looking at the graphic.
Someone is in the minus numbers.
Right. See you tomorrow, folks. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.